Okay, so the scene is 1805 in the little township of Royalton, Vermont. It's December and it's cold. Anyone that's been in Vermont knows that you can expect long, humid summers and cold, snowy winters with snow in the trees of maple and birch and beech. You've got pine trees everywhere. It's thick with growth. It would have been a cold winter in a small log cabin. After the failed ginseng venture and Lucy Mack Smith losing her large wedding dowry, which we covered in last episode, the Smiths would find themselves in the beginnings of a poverty cycle. It was hard enough to be on the frontier, but to be poor on the frontier was another story. Over the course of the next 14 years, the family would move 7 times. The farm they were renting would be sold, they would hear of a better opportunity somewhere, and off they would go, trying to seek out a new way to eke out a living. During this period, they never moved far, and extended family was always nearby, but they did move a lot. And one of their little stops found them in the little township of Vermont, and it was there 2 days before Christmas in 1805 that Lucy would give birth to a son they named after his father, Joseph. It's this birth that would change the course of history for millions of people, and the family's identity would be forever tied up with the fate of this child. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
It's interesting that, like the protagonist Nephi in the work of scripture he would produce, the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith Jr. wasn't the oldest child, but he certainly would do the most to shape the course of this family. He had 3 older siblings, Alvin, Hiram, and Sophronia, and 5 more would come later: Samuel, William, Catherine, Don Carlos, and Lucy. The family did what they could to provide for themselves. We mentioned a little bit last time that they brewed and sold root beer. Lucy did kind of folksy oilcloth paintings. And Joseph Smith Sr. taught school off and on. And they managed to survive somehow. And in talking about the struggle for providing for a family at this time, historian Richard Bushman noted, quote, "Adult life was a race to accumulate sufficient goods to give the children a start and still have enough to be independent and comfortable in old age."
So it's already hard to eke out a living. Lucy would have had money. Her new husband lost it all in this, you know, crazy ginseng craze. And now they're surviving on sort of cottage industries, what they can make. And the Smith family would survive pretty well until Joseph Smith Jr. was 6 years old. It would be that year that an epidemic of typhoid fever raged through the area. Typhoid fever, caused by bacteria, is a disease that spreads easily due to contamination in a time when sanitation was not only not understood, it was practically non-existent. And the Smith family would not be immune. They were hit pretty hard. Joseph Smith's older sister, Sophronia, was given up and thought to be dead at one point. Following the fever period, Joseph Jr. would have a large sore that would develop. And 20 years later, Joseph remembered that the doctors, not knowing what else to do, quote, freely applied the hot shovel, which did no good. So you can imagine having an open sore and doctors who are just people on the frontier making their own, sticking a shovel in the fire and then sticking it on your wound. Not fun. When the sore was finally cut open, and this is gross, so buckle up, Lucy noted that, quote, it discharged fully a quart of matter. I do a lot of canning and a quart jar is a lot, but I don't want to know what that matter was. This sore healed, but then an infection developed in his shin. So fun facts, folks, don't put hot shovels on open wounds.
Medical treatment for this type of infection was usually just to amputate the arm or leg. Coincidentally, however, Smith family lived just a few miles from Dartmouth Medical College, where the resident surgeon, Nathan Smith, apparently no relation to them, had been developing this revolutionary cure for this illness. So his treatment...
Was it ginseng?
No. He talked to Joseph Smith, and Joseph Smith was like, dude, stay away from ginseng. You'll lose all your money, trust me. So his treatment was... They would chip away the diseased bone that surrounded the infection using bone drills and saws. Remember, you don't have electricity, so these would have been done by keys that would turn gears. And you can imagine Lucy's distress hearing her son screaming from the obvious pain this operation would have caused. They described the sheets just being soaked in blood. I mean, this would have been really horrific to watch. And this is 30 years before they start using ether as an anesthetic. So your options were really limited. I mean, basically the only thing you had was to get the patient drunk. And so Lucy later described how Joseph refused alcohol that the doctors had suggested. And Mormons never once to turn down a good, you know, faith-promoting word of wisdom story. We're like, oh, look, this is word of wisdom. He's not drinking alcohol. No. Why he refused it? Good question, but remember the word of wisdom is a long ways away, and the Smiths, like basically everyone in America, drank a lot of alcohol. If I remember right, the average was something like 8 gallons per person per year. So yeah, definitely not a word of wisdom story.
Okay, so Brian, this story is something that is sort of seared in the psyche of every Mormon. We heard this in primary, and again, the way that you just described it is the way I was taught. Since modern Mormons abstain from alcohol, we were taught that, you know, Joseph Smith had this foresight as a young boy. He had the surgery and he gave up alcohol. Not true. We know we have plenty of accounts of Joseph Smith drinking throughout his life. I'm going to read a little clip from LDS.org. This is an article titled Joseph Smith's Boyhood Surgery by Vivian M. Adams. And the little subtitle is How Did Faith, Courage, and the Unique Skills of Dr. Nathan Smith Save 7-Year-Old Joseph Smith's Leg in His Life 200 Years Ago? So they describe the typhoid fever, and then they talk about the actual surgery. So this is a little gruesome, so just be prepared. What Joseph later called typhus fever afflicted many in Lebanon in 1813. Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy, reported that the epidemic caused her family, quote, one whole year of affliction, disease, pain, and trouble. And she was grateful for the attention given to young Joseph by his brother Hiram. Joseph later recalled that during this year of affliction, quote, my father despaired of my life, end quote. Doctors were able to reduce the fever, but not the pain that settled in Joseph's shoulder. Hoping to alleviate his pain, Joseph's parents sent for Dr. Parker, a Lebanon physician, who insisted the distress was caused by a sprain and administered a bone ailment, which proved ineffective. When Dr. Parker called again, he discovered, quote, a very large fever sore between Joseph's breast and shoulder. When the sore was lanced, a full quarter of matter, like we talked about, was discharged. The pain in Joseph's shoulder, quote, shot like lightning down his side into the marrow of his leg bone on the same side. It's assumed that bacteria from the shoulder abscess spread through the bloodstream in the tibia of his left leg. Joseph cried out in anguish, quote, oh, Father, the pain is so severe. How can I bear it? And the infected leg began to swell. After 3 weeks of excruciating pain, Joseph was attended by Dr. Stone, a surgeon from Hanover, who made an 8-inch incision between Joseph's knee and ankle, hoping to alleviate the boy's distress. As the incision healed, Joseph's mother reported, quote, the pain became as violent as ever. A second and longer incision was made again. As the healing process progressed, the swelling continued to rise. So then a council of surgeons get together. They say you got to amputate it. Joseph Smith refused amputation. That's something that you should know. And Lucy Mack said, don't amputate either. So Dr. Nathan Smith had developed an experimental surgery cutting through new bone growth in order to extract the infected bone from the interior cavity. Dr. Smith agreed to save Joseph's legs by performing the surgery. So Joseph Smith tells his parents he could endure the surgery without alcohol as a sedative. It's said that he declared, quote, I will do whatever is necessary to be done in order to have the bone taken out. The Lord will help me. I shall get through. So they do this surgery. They cut into his leg and remove 9 large pieces of his bone. You can imagine how painful this is without a sedative. And eventually it heals. And Joseph would have seen this as a miraculous event. Now, this story is retold as Joseph refusing alcohol, and that is what his faith was rewarded. But this is more about Joseph being able to endure the pain so his leg isn't amputated. He's showing, I can handle it. Let's get it done. But I imagine it was an excruciating surgery. It clearly affected all of the family, and that is why we hear about it so many times today. But no, this is not a word of wisdom story. Here's the actual quote that we have. This is another quote that we have recorded that Joseph Smith said, that they came in and the doctor said, will you have some brandy? And Joseph allegedly said, quote, I will not touch one particle of liquor, neither will I be tied down, but I will tell you what I will do. I will have my father sit on my bed and hold me in his arms, and then I will do whatever is necessary in order to have the bone taken out. This, according to his mother, he said, quote, Mother, I want you to leave the room, for I know you cannot bear to suffer so. Father can stand it, but you have carried me so much and watched over me so long, you are almost worn out. And then, with tears in his eyes, he said, Now, Mother, promise me that you will not stay, will you? The Lord will help me, and I shall get through with it. End quote. I want to point this out because that's a pretty articulate 6-year-old.
And remember, these are all later reminiscences of the events, so you kind of have to take that into account. One interesting idea as to alcohol and the surgery, historian Dan Vogel in his biography of Joseph Smith suggested that Joseph Jr. had seen the effects that alcohol had had on his father, who apparently drank quite a bit and had caused some problems. And his thinking is that perhaps young Joseph Jr. is like, I've seen what alcohol has done. I will pass. Thank you very much.
There's some really interesting scholarly work on trauma in children and how trauma like this affects them later on. And this could be applied to this. The idea of having a traumatic event leaves you with a lot of emotional scars. Joseph Smith would describe this surgery himself as brutal and gruesome. And even through the eyes of a surgeon, it was a really, really brutal surgery. And if you're interested, Brian, tell us about the plastic surgeon who has a book about this.
So Bill Moraine is a plastic surgeon that's treated a lot of trauma victims throughout his career. And as a result of that, he wrote a book called The Sword of Laban, where he argues that the trauma of this surgery created a mental dissociation in Joseph Smith, and that would be responsible for his visions and different spiritual manifestations later in life. So we'll link to that if that sounds interesting to you.
Everyone's always trying to figure out how Joseph had these visions, right? What the explanations are. But we talk about Joseph, but I am a mother, and I can imagine, I can't actually imagine having my son broke his arm this year, and just having him, you know, have his arm set with anesthesia was really difficult. So how did Lucy process these events as his mother? Well, we do know how she handled some of the trauma in her family. For example, when her daughter Sophronia was near death, Lucy described how she and Joseph Sr., quote, clasped our hands together and fell upon our knees by the bedside and poured our grief and supplications into his ears who hath numbered the hair upon our heads. Then think it not strange if he heard us. He did hear us, and I felt assured that he would answer our prayers. So if you listened to last episode, this is a theme for Lucy. She would pray and she would experience these miraculous healings, including in her own children. Listen again to the power of faith as she appeals directly to her readers in her own memoir, quote, My reader, are you a parent? Place yourself in the same situation. Are you a mother that has ever been in like circumstances? Feel for your heartstrings. Can you tell me how I felt with my expiring child strained to my bosom, which thrilled with all a mother's love, a mother's tender yearnings for her own offspring? Would you then feel to deny that God had power to save the utmost all who call on him? I did not then, and I do not now. End quote. It is very striking to read her description of Joseph's surgery, the leg surgery, as everyone was gathered in the bedroom. Lucy spoke up, quote, Now, said I, gentlemen, because there were 7 guys in the room, what can you do to save my boy's leg? And she did, you know, and they said, well, here are all the things we can do. And eventually they ended up cutting out 9 parts of his leg with no brandy or anesthesia. In the early 1800s, for a woman to take part in the discussion of a council of surgeons to determine the best course of action was quite unusual. Lucy clearly felt that she had every right to make her voice heard. It's the power of a mother's love, I guess. Throughout her life, such as the move to Kirtland, where she took charge, Lucy would display strength of character and the will to get things done. But time out. Before we get too much further, we need to fix a problem. Most people who have any interest in Mormon history can probably name several, maybe all, of the brothers of the Smith family. There were sisters. Several of them, actually, and you should know who they are. They are important and they influence the course of the family. First, Sophronia, you've heard about her. She was born in 1803, in between Hiram and Joseph, and she was the last child born in Vermont. The first known significant event in her life came when she was 9 years old. So we've all heard the Joseph Smith leg surgery story. We just told you it again. But Joseph wasn't the first to get this disease. Sophronia actually had it first, so the family would have been familiar with it. After suffering for 3 months, and towards the end she would just lay in a comatose state, the doctors basically said she's dead. They gave her up for dead. In her memoirs that we discussed last episode, Lucy Mack Smith tells a poignant story of walking the floor with Sophronia, who was seemingly dead at this point, in her arms until she started crying and came to. We've brought on historian Christopher C. Smith to talk a little bit about some unknown things about Joseph Smith's family you might not know about.
Hi, I'm Christopher C. Smith. I have a PhD in religious studies from Claremont Graduate University, and I most recently taught American religious history at Utah State University. Yeah, so let's talk about Sophronia's tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is a crazy disease. This is a disease scientists estimate has killed about 1 billion people in the course of its history. In the 18th and 19th centuries, about 25% of all adult deaths in Europe and America were caused by tuberculosis. That's 1 in 4 people who died of tuberculosis. That is insane. And of course, this is a disease that we don't hear much about today because it's a bacterial disease. And so the advent of sanitation and antibiotics has really reduced the rate of infections. There's still, you know, quite a few people who get this, but mostly in what's called the third world, countries that are underdeveloped, that are poor, and that don't have a lot of access to good sanitation and good healthcare. This is a disease that the primary symptoms are coughing. It makes you look emaciated, so you become really thin and sunken cheekbones and sunken eyes. You have constant diarrhea. You can get fevers. You'll cough up blood a lot and phlegm. And so when you think about those symptoms, those are not exactly pretty symptoms, but it's kind of interesting because this became known as a beautiful disease. It was kind of romanticized in the 19th century, and it became especially associated with respectable women, literary women, poets. And part of that is because it actually sort of jived with the 19th century ideal of beauty for women. So women were supposed to be thin, they were supposed to be pale, that was the ideal. Rosy cheeks, it would kind of cause some flushing in the face sometimes, so you'd have pale skin and rosy cheeks that stood out against the pale skin, and also really bright red lips. And so this was considered so beautiful that some women actually would wear makeup in order to imitate the disease. It's been called tubercular chic, this fashion for looking like you have tuberculosis. And also, tuberculosis took a long time to die, so you had a lot of time to get your soul right with God. So it was considered a beautiful death. And in fact, fevers induce hallucinations. So you read a lot of stories about people with TB having transformative religious visions in the throes of a TB-related fever. So you get a lot of people kind of converting as a result of the disease. Of course, all of this romanticism about a disease is kind of off base. And let me tell you, there's nothing romantic about dying of a horrible disease. Fortunately, we've mostly wiped this out today. But just so you know, anytime you run across the word consumption in a 19th century source, you're reading about tuberculosis, this terrible disease that has killed 1 billion people, and that in the 19th century killed about 1/4 of all the people who died.
So Sophronia didn't have the luxury of being this romantic Victorian beauty. She had things pretty hard. She grew up in a very poor family. Her ears actually played a role in this story. When the family moved to New York after the year without a spring, and we can talk about what that is in just a minute, they're about to leave when creditors start appearing. Because the family's poor, they're not paying their creditors. Lucy, by herself, since Joseph Smith Sr. had gone ahead to prepare things, has had to deal with all of this, not to mention taking care of all these little children. And she's forced to give up just about everything, including Sophronia's earrings, to pay the debts. So maybe when Gordon B. Hinckley, the modern prophet, told us to take out the pair of earrings, it was in honor of Sophronia, whose earrings were sold to pay off the debts. It's around this time that Joseph Smith later said he experienced his first vision. Sophronia joined the local Presbyterian church along with Lucy and two of the brothers. Once Joseph began to become more serious about his course, the rest of the family drops out of that church attendance and starts following what Joseph Smith is doing. In 1827, Sophronia marries Calvin Stoddard, who was interested in religion and had stopped by the Smith house to hear about one of Joseph's experiences. Back to Chris Smith to tell us a little bit about Calvin Stoddard.
Sophronia's husband, Calvin Stoddard, is a really interesting character. A non-Mormon named Stephen Harding, who would later become the governor of Utah, visited the Smith family in 1830, about the time that they published the Book of Mormon. And he was so amused by the Smith's belief in dreams and visions and all this stuff that he decided to play a few pranks on them. And one of them he played on Calvin Stoddard. So Harding knew that Joseph Smith had commanded Stoddard to undertake a Mormon mission, but that he had some doubts about it. So Harding creeps up outside of Stoddard's house at night while Stoddard's sleeping, takes a big rock and he raps it against the door three times, boom, boom, boom. Then he shouts, "Calvin Stoddard, the angel of the Lord commands that before another going down of the sun, thou shalt go forth among the people and preach the gospel of Nephi, or thy wife shall be a widow, thy children orphans, and thy ashes scattered to the four winds of heaven." And the next morning, Calvin departs on a mission and tells all his neighbors about this vision. And we know that Harding didn't just make this story up, because the vision is reported in a local newspaper. The Palmyra Reflector said, "Some few evenings since, a man in the town of Mendon, New York, had a loud call to go and preach the doctrines contained in the Gold Bible under heavy denunciations." As far as I know, Calvin never found out that he'd been had. He died a long time before Stephen Harding published this story, so he probably never knew that this vision was a prank that somebody had played upon him. Despite this initial visionary experience, Calvin had a lot of problems with the church. And I think when you have to acknowledge your brother-in-law as a prophet, that can be a hard pill to swallow. And we see him having a lot of disagreements with Joseph Smith. On December 29, 1832, Calvin gives up his elder's license and confesses that he had not magnified his office, but had transgressed and been out of the way. And unfortunately, the sources don't tell us what the transgression was on this occasion, but I'm thinking it's probably some kind of disagreement with Joseph Smith, because that is what happens on several subsequent occasions. One of those disagreements was in June 1835 about whether there was water under a particular lot of land. As I'm sure you guys will get into in the next episode, Lindsay and Brian, Joseph Smith had a divining rod that he could use to locate treasure and lost objects and water. And Calvin also had a rod, and he was a water witch, and he used his rod to determine that under this lot at Kirtland, there was water. And Joseph Smith said, "No, there isn't water there." And so this led to the two men coming to harsh words and eventually blows. So Calvin yells at Joseph and calls him a damned false prophet. And Joseph and Calvin threaten each other. And Calvin says, "I don't fear you nor any man." And he raises his cane and he says he's going to flog Joseph. Then Joseph walks over to Calvin and he hits him in the forehead with the flat of his hand, which knocks Calvin onto his back. And then Joseph straddles Calvin and hits him in the head four or five more times, hits him so hard that Calvin temporarily goes blind. Afterward, the two men reconcile. Joseph Smith apologizes to Calvin and asks his forgiveness. Calvin forgave him. And then when Joseph was arrested for assault, Calvin actually skips town in order to avoid testifying against him. And when Calvin returns to town, the court actually had to drag him in against his will and make him tell the story. So Calvin at least is, you know, fairly faithful to his brother-in-law in this legal matter. And ultimately, the court acquits Joseph because Calvin decided not to press charges, and also because the assault may have been... the court's exact words are, the assault might perhaps be justified on the principle of self-defense. This, unfortunately, doesn't end the conflicts between Calvin and Joseph. There's another fight on January 1st, 1836, in a church council meeting. Calvin and William Smith apparently have some harsh words for Joseph in this council meeting. William quickly apologized and was reconciled. Calvin took until March to confess his fault. And it's not clear whether that even brought a temporary reconciliation, because 7 months later, Calvin dies out of communion with the church, apparently. We don't know the cause of his death. Honestly, I have to wonder whether being hit in the head a bunch of times might have had something to do with it, but who knows? Could be any number of things. His obituary doesn't say. And whoever was with Calvin when he died took his elder's license and presented it a few days later to the Kirtland Elders Quorum, and the quorum actually discussed posthumously revoking this elder's license, but ultimately they voted to retain the license and not to raise our hands against him.
Thanks, Chris. It's kind of amazing to me to think of all the wild sort of stories. I mean, Joseph Smith didn't just beat up his brother-in-law. He had problems with his own brother, William Smith, too. But we'll talk about that later. Let's get back to Sophronia and her little family. This young family joined the Mormon movement and moves to Kirtland, and there Sophronia got to partake of the new Mormon tradition of mothers trying to provide for their family while their husbands leave on missions. She and her sisters seem to have bonded even more during this time as they tried to keep their families going. Sophronia had yet another brush with death as she suffered with, you guessed it, consumption, but she was able to recover. But it was several years later that Calvin comes down with this same terrible disease. Though he had some conflict with her brother and other church leaders, he seemed to have reconciled everything, which turned out to be very good timing, because tuberculosis was going to be fatal, and Sophronia knew this. She had seen it before. It was obviously in her mother's family, and so she took him back to her family in New York, where he died. At the age of 34, Sophronia returned to Kirtland as a single mother. And in 1838, she remarries to William McCleary, and they move to Missouri. And there's this great story when Joseph and the others escaped from jail and came across to Illinois. They came to the McCleary house in Lima, which is just south of Nauvoo. And one observer reported, quote, "Their sister, wife of Brother McCleary, hurried to and fro, pressing them to partake of refreshments, at the same time telling them how anxious they had been and how fearful they were lest the mob would take their lives," end quote. So for Sophronia, Mormonism wasn't just a religion, it was literally her family. When Joseph Sr. was on his deathbed in Nauvoo, her father, he gives each of his kids a blessing recorded by Lucy Mack Smith in her memoirs. And this is what he tells Sophronia, quote,
"Sophronia, my oldest daughter, thou hadst sickness when thou wast young, and thy parents did cry over thee to have the Lord spare thy life. Thou didst see trouble and sorrow, but thy troubles shall be lessened, for thou hast been faithful in helping thy father and thy mother in the work of the Lord. And thou shalt be blessed, and the blessings of heaven shall rest down upon thee. Thy last days shall be thy best days. Although thou shalt see trouble, sorrow, and mourning, thou shalt be comforted, and the Lord will lift thee up and bless you and your family, and you thou desirest life. This dying blessing I pronounce and seal upon your head with your other blessings. Even so, amen."
I wish I had heard more about Sophronia growing up. I think it would have given me a model of an early Mormon woman. We had Emma Smith and we had Lucy Mack, and that's really all I had heard about. But Sophronia went through a lot. In Nauvoo, she experienced being a mission wife as William McCleary was gone for a long period. And during this time, her brother, Samuel's wife, Mary Bailey, died, as well as her younger brother, Don Carlos. In 1843, Joseph Smith and others would travel to Ramus, east, which is east of Nauvoo, where Sophronia was living. While they were visiting, Joseph preached on various topics such as seer stones and the nature of God, and 30 years later, Orson Pratt added these teachings to the Doctrine and Covenants, which we now know as Section 130. Now, Sophronia would go on to live a full life. She was very engaged in this. And following the death of her brothers at Carthage in June of 1844, Sophronia remained with the Mormons and she followed Brigham Young. She actually doesn't stay with Emma Smith. She goes on with Brigham Young. She and William participated in the washing and anointing and the endowment in the not quite finished Nauvoo Temple and apparently were planning to come west. So she's ready to go. She's ready to get ready to go. She's going to join the Brighamite movement. And during this period, some of the family seemed to have leaned towards James Strang as a leader, but that doesn't last very long. When the Mormons finally leave Nauvoo, Sophronia, her mothers and sisters, left for Knoxville north of Nauvoo. William McCleary, however, her husband, is with the main body of Brigham Young's followers, and at this point he disappears. There is zero record of what happened. One letter hints that Sophronia is a widow, but we just don't know what happened. In later years, she stays in Nauvoo, often living with her daughter, and 3 years before her death in 1876, she and her sister Lucy joined the RLDS Church, led by her nephew, Joseph Smith III. So most of the Smith siblings stay back. Sophronia plans to go west, it seems because of her husband, but then something happens and it causes her to stay back. Before we get into the other sisters, though, I want to talk about a phrase that I just mentioned a little while ago, which is the year of no summer. Do you want to talk about what that is, Brian?
So it's an interesting worldwide catastrophe. So Mount Tambora explodes halfway across the world and shoots just an enormous quantity of ash, dust, and rocks up into the atmosphere. So much so that as it goes around the world, it's basically like this blanket over the earth. And so that year, there's basically no summer. The sun is not getting through enough. And so there's reports of snow into, I want to say, June. And in an economy which is based almost entirely on agriculture at this point, you can imagine that this causes serious problems. So Vermont, which had been this just green paradise, had been really good for farming, but after this, not so good. And so the Smith family, like thousands of others, hit the road and end up going back to New York from whence they'd come.
It's hard for me to imagine in a modern sort of developed world what it's like to move so many times. I mean, I just recently moved and it's, you know, I've got boxes and it's hard and moving trucks and all of that. But to move because your family is starving, that's not something I've ever had to experience. And so I can't imagine sort of the grating on your anxiety and your psyche that this constant survival mentality would bring to you. But it seems that relief was found with spirituality. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say so. And I mean, yeah, just think about it. If you're a farmer, you're a farmer. And, you know, there's no temp agencies you can go to. You don't really have a lot of recourse. So they just had to, well, let's try somewhere else and hope for better. So, yeah, that was a very impactful event on them, like so many others. Okay, next sister is Catherine. So she's born in 1813, right in the middle of the crazy typhoid fever season. So while her mother, Lucy, is dealing with typhoid fever, but then all the other children. I mean, imagine a household where the normal responsibilities of cooking on a wood-burning fire, washing clothes. I mean, all the things that are so much easier to do now are much harder. So she's got all of this. But then, one by one, her children start coming down with this terrible disease that leaves them basically just bedridden for months at a time. And to boot, she's pregnant with Catherine at this point. Later on, Catherine, who was apparently stronger than her older sister Sophronia, remember she has typhoid and then she has consumption. I mean, it seems like she was a little bit weaker. Because of this, Catherine gets a larger than usual share of the housework. And also, a little bit later on, her younger sister Lucy, not to be confused with the mother, Lucy, she takes care of her a lot of the time. And because of this, the two really had a close bond throughout their life. And so Catherine was obviously well acquainted with all of these big early events in Mormon history. She describes that when Joseph Smith comes home with the plates for the Book of Mormon for the first time, he hands them to her and they put his thumb back in its socket. He apparently dislocated his thumb and then he faints. And then a little after that, people are always after the plates. And so she remembers Joseph coming into their room at night and sticks the plates in the bed that she and Sophronia shared. So he sticks it between them and then puts the blanket over. And then dudes come running through the house. Where are the plates? And can't find them. So she was intimately acquainted with all this. Then another time, this is interesting. She's dusting the room and the plates are on the table. So she picks them up and kind of curious, runs her finger up the side and heard, quote, the tinkle of sound that they made. So this was, you know, this was happening in her own house. Back to the poverty theme. So we've talked about how much this affected their family. So Catherine apparently has to leave home as a young teenager. They can't support all of the children. So she leaves to teach school. So picture, you know, if you're Anne of Green Gables, picture her getting the town school or something. And then once their family circumstances got a little bit better, she was able to come home. And then she herself got to attend school with some of the younger siblings. And if you remember at this period, the Smith family is there in New York, but then Joseph Smith Jr. leaves with his wife Emma, and they go down to Pennsylvania, where Emma's family was, for a time. And while Joseph is down in Pennsylvania, the Smith family back in New York moves near Fayette. While they're there in Fayette, Catherine meets Jenkins Salisbury, who is a lawyer, but a blacksmith most of the time. No one had one, just one occupation mostly. And Jenkins will eventually become a believer in the Smith family's religion. And so he moves to Kirtland. The Smith family moves to Kirtland. And they renew their relationship and are actually married not too long after they get there. But Jenkins and Mormonism did not have a pleasant time together in Kirtland. So he had various different conflicts with the leaders. Remember, they're not just the leaders, they're his brothers-in-law. So it's a different kind of relationship. And he's accused one time of, quote, intemperance. And so you think about this. We've talked about alcohol already a few times. I mean, this is an era where you don't want to drink water most of the time. I mean, they don't understand how waterborne illnesses happen, but they understand that they do happen to some degree. So alcohol was kind of one way around this. In the fermentation process, you could kill bacteria. And so most of the time, it's far healthier to drink that than water. So in this era, if you're being accused of intemperance, it's obviously going to have to be somewhat excessive. But back up here, and we have to remember, we've mentioned this a little bit, Joseph Smith Sr., and then the children, Joseph, Hiram, there are rumors and accusations that they like to drink quite a bit themselves, so they wouldn't have been too far from this. So Jenkins, after the Zion's Camp march, he ends up being cut off from the church on these charges, but then the family members reach out to him, and apparently Joseph Smith Sr. personally encourage him to come back, and he does, and they put him in the initial quorum of 70. But his reformation doesn't last very long, and he's again excommunicated. So over the next decade, Catherine is in a very tough place. So she's most of the time she's living outside of Kirtland, so she's not there with her family. She's not with the main body of Mormons, so she's stuck. On the one hand, she has the loyalty to her family, and by extension, Mormonism, but then she's also loyal to her husband, Jenkins. So she tries to stay involved. And apparently she visited Kirtland quite a bit and would do different projects with her sister. Interesting side note here, I have a soft spot for this. She seemed to get her share of the Smith family tall genes. So the average height at that point was quite a bit lower than it was today. So tall people really would have stuck out, and the Smiths were quite tall. Catherine was reported to be 6 inches taller than the average woman and very strong. So she, you know, she could do her share of the work. All right, now, picture the craziness of the end of Kirtland. You've got the collapse of the Kirtland Safety Society, you have mass apostasy, you have riots in the Kirtland Temple, quite a crazy period. So the main body Mormons leaves and goes to Missouri, where things are going to get crazier. But during this time, life didn't feel like pausing so women could have babies, for example. So Catherine gave birth in a wagon and then spent the next week after giving birth in the wagon, and they're traveling, you know, 10, 20 miles a day over dirt roads, bouncing, and this would have been uncomfortable for everyone, let alone a woman who's just given birth, and that's how she gets to Missouri. Then, after a couple of years, the Mormons move on to Illinois, and she ends up in a little town called Plymouth. So this is tucked away in the southeast corner of Hancock County, where Nauvoo was. So in a pre-cars era, this is going to be probably, I would guess, at least a couple days journey to get to Nauvoo in a wagon. So she's kind of isolated there. For a time, her brother William lived there, and her brother Samuel also. But most of the time, it's just her and Jenkins there. And Jenkins is gone a lot. So honestly, she's essentially a single mother for much of this period. And then William ends up moving to Nauvoo. Samuel moves back, but they stay there. And so the family realizes this, the Smith family, and so they try to reach out to her. So they would go out and visit her. And on one of these visits, Joseph, her brother, goes to visit, and Willard Richards, who's keeping his journal, noted, quote, "While there, my heart was pained to see a sister of Joseph's, almost barefoot, and four lovely children entirely so in the midst of a severe winter," close quote. So they had it pretty hard. And just because you're a Smith, it didn't mean that you were free from financial difficulties. So Jenkins is off. He's most of the time he'll be in St. Louis trying to find work and sending back whatever he can. So Catherine has a really hard time taking care of everything. So the solution is they have another Mormon family there in Plymouth would moved in with them and tried to help take care of things. Then in mid-June 1844, Catherine is visiting Nauvoo, and this is right when Joseph and Hiram are about to leave for Carthage and where they'll eventually get killed. So she decides to go back to Plymouth. But basically, she gets there just in time to hear that the brothers have been killed. So she turns around, goes back to Nauvoo, and leaves her children with this family that had moved in with them. And on the heels of this grief of her brothers being killed, the family that's moved in with them is terrified that they're going to be targeted as Mormons. So what do? They just leave the children there by themselves. And so the children go to their neighbors and say, "Hey, can you take care of us?" And apparently they do for a couple days, but then they're afraid that by sheltering the Smith children, they're going to be targeted. So they're like, "Get out of here. Go back to your house." So sadly, Catherine comes home to find her children alone in an empty house with no one taking care of them. Like, this would have been really, really hard to deal with. But after this, surprisingly, things actually start to improve for her family. So as time goes on, and Hancock County really starts to turn against Mormons. They apparently would have notes tacked to their door saying, "You're next." And so they realize, all right, we got to get out of Plymouth. So they move back to Nauvoo with the main body there. Jenkins is still away in St. Louis, but at least Catherine has her family. So she kind of gets some stability back in her life. And after a decade of basically no contact with Mormonism, her husband Jenkins decides to make peace with the leaders, and things are going pretty well. But then William Smith comes back to Nauvoo. We're going to call him the Smith brother who turned everything he touched to crap. So he, as he pretty much always did, stirred things up. And he kind of sets the tone for the Smith family and turns them against Brigham Young. And so William and Jenkins decide they are going to leave. They're afraid for their safety, but they leave the women there. That was very chivalrous of them, wasn't it? And so after the main body of Mormons leaves Nauvoo with Brigham Young, Jenkins comes back to get his family, but then tragedy strikes again. So they're headed on the river in a boat, which crashes. So again, back to Oregon Trail. This is when you're trying to caulk your wagon and float it across and it doesn't quite work. So they lose basically everything they own in the river, which wasn't much to begin with, and are forced to swim to shore to survive. And they make it, but then they're on the river. If you've ever been to Nauvoo or anywhere around the Mississippi River, you know how many mosquitoes there are there. But the problem is they don't realize that mosquitoes are causing malaria, or the ague, they called it. And so they all get this, and they manage to survive it, but then their youngest child, sadly, dies of malnutrition. So they were really, really poor. So eventually they end back up in Illinois. They move around a few times. They go to a little place called Webster, east of Nauvoo, where some Mormons had lived before. And once again, they're just getting stability back in their life. And then Jenkins gets malaria again and dies in 1853. So then Catherine chooses to move the family to another little town called Fountain Green. She gets remarried, but it apparently only lasted a few months. So Catherine would stay there in Fountain Green for the rest of her life. And it's apparently well known that she's Joseph Smith's sister, which in Illinois in the 1850s is not going to win you any friends. So they're apparently targeted. And sadly, her son eventually gets stabbed to death by a neighbor who did not like the Smiths. So it was very tragic for them. So Catherine isn't really willing to acknowledge Brigham Young as the leader of the Mormon movement, but she apparently did stay on reasonably good terms. At one point, Brigham Young sent her $200 to buy some property. Then in 1873, we mentioned already that she, along with her sisters, joined the RLDS Church, which was headed by her nephew, Joseph Smith III. What's interesting about this is the two other sisters, their original baptism in the Joseph Smith era was just honored and they were accepted. But Catherine apparently chose to be rebaptized and kind of evidence her commitment. So, and early on, it doesn't seem like that she had too much contact with the RLDS movement, but then in later years, it was recognized how many memories and what a role she had played. So she wrote several articles for the Saints Herald, the RLDS periodical, and she would tell these amazing stories that we talked about of having Joseph Smith hand her the plates and stick the plates in her bed for safekeeping. So they recognized what an important role she had. And then she eventually passes away in 1900 at the age of 86, being the longest survived Smith sibling.
So the Smiths may have thought that their childbearing years were over when Don Carlos was born. But 5 years later, I mean, Lucy Mack had gobs and gobs of kids.
Yep.
So the idea that she waited 5 years for another Lucy to be born. So now we have a Lucy Senior and a Lucy Junior. How many of you listening that grew up Mormon knew that? Lucy was born when her mother, Lucy, had just turned 46. She would be 2 years old when her brother Alvin died. And Alvin's death, we're going to talk about, has a big influence on the family. Lucy Senior tells a very sad story of Alvin asking to see her on his deathbed. Lucy Jr. was so little that she would have been oblivious to much of what was going on. Anyone who has had kids knows that recordings of milestones tapers off for the younger kids. You sort of start ignoring the younger kids. You do all the cool stuff with the older kids. But by the time you're little Lucy Jr., nobody really pays attention. And Lucy Jr. seems to be no exception. Very little is known of her childhood. Her patriarchal blessing basically just says, "You're the youngest." So she really comes in the picture more when she marries Arthur Milken in Nauvoo, and they had known each other earlier. The best story with Arthur is that he was temporarily cut off from the church for dancing in Kirtland. Good old Footloose Milken getting cut off and sent away for dancing. I wonder what kind of dancing it was that got him cut off, because
scandalous
foot tapping. And her brother Joseph married them in 1840. When Joseph Smith Sr. was on his deathbed. Again, his deathbed was like a big deal. We have a lot about his deathbed. He again blesses Lucy with basically, "You're the youngest, good for you," but adds a request to take care of her mother. So for the rest of Lucy Senior's life, she was almost never separated from her youngest daughter because it was sort of outlined in her patriarchal blessing. Apparently, Lucy Jr. took the opportunity to get after Joseph Smith III, who takes over the RLDS Church, that day because he didn't cry. She said he was too hard-hearted. Life for Lucy and Arthur in Nauvoo was fairly uneventful. He worked as a clerk in the red brick store, and they were seen as good citizens and Mormons. In 1843, Arthur and Lucy went on a mission to Saco, Maine, where Arthur grew up, and it's the home of the Cochranites, if you're paying attention. And while there, their first child was born in Arthur's childhood home. They get back from Nauvoo in 1844, just a month before Lucy's brothers are killed. Following their deaths, the presence of dudes thought to have conspired in their murders was not okay with people in Nauvoo. So a committee involving several Smith women, including Lucy, paid not too friendly visits to some of them and told them to hit the road. I love this idea of, like, we have the whistling, whittling elders, but we also have the, like, finger-wagging sisters who went and said, like, "You better shape up and not come after my brothers." Life settled back in to normalcy until William Smith gets back. And we're going to have to do a whole episode on William Smith because he was a little scamp. But William gets back. Her husband Arthur was often his scribe for patriarchal blessings. And not surprisingly, the family had a bad falling out with Brother Brigham. It's so interesting to know that none of the original Smiths really liked Brigham Young very much. As Nauvoo became more and more unsafe, they left for various places to the north and east, like Knoxville, Fountain Green, Webster. Most of the time, at least one of Lucy's sisters was living nearby. Then they moved to Colchester, a mining and railroad town about 40 miles east of Nauvoo. Like the rest of the Smiths that remained in the Midwest, Lucy periodically received visits from her Utah relatives as they would come through. And apparently she was more friendly during these visits than some of the other Midwest Smiths, so she was a friendly place to stop by. However, once Joseph Smith III assumed leadership of the RLDS Church, she and Arthur wrote a letter to the Utah Smiths. After a family talk, he gets down to business. This is what the letter says, quote, "I do not see how you boys can preach Brigham the successor to Joseph, or that he has any more authority than he had when Joseph died. I never shall believe it," end quote. And I can't wait to talk about the succession crisis and what a dumpster fire of a mess that was, but we'll get into that later on. But apparently, Arthur and Lucy never believed in Brigham Young's authority. In 1873, Lucy and her sisters joined the RLDS Church, but they don't seem to have been very involved. In 1882, Lucy was taking care of her daughter-in-law, who had the dreaded consumption and caught it and died. Let's hear one more note about the Smith family from Christopher C. Smith.
The difficulties that Sophronia and Catherine's husbands had with the church, unfortunately, kind of lead to these women being eclipsed in some ways. In 1834, there's a meeting, a family meeting at the Joseph Smith's house to receive patriarchal blessings from Joseph Smith Sr. And we actually have recorded the blessings that Joseph Smith Sr. gave to every member of the family, including these women. Now, Calvin Stoddard was there, and at the time he was out of communion with the church, and so his Joseph Smith Sr. kind of takes the opportunity to humiliate him, unfortunately, in this blessing. Joseph Smith Sr. starts by exhorting him to humble himself before the Lord and to repent of his sins, and says in the blessing, "Calvin, my son-in-law, thou hast conducted foolishly and suffered the devil to toss thee about and to sift thee many times. The church has been grieved with thy conduct, and thy family has been sorely afflicted because of thy wickedness. The Lord has given thee a talent, and he will require an account of the same in eternity." And so Calvin's blessing ends up being not a blessing, but a call to repentance. And this kind of ends up infiltrating Sophronia's blessing, too. Most of her blessing ends up being about her husband's sin, which is pretty unfortunate. The blessing says, "Sophronia, my daughter, the Lord has seen fit in his providence to afflict you with much sickness," meaning the tuberculosis, "and much sorrow because of the conduct of thy husband." So apparently her tuberculosis was Calvin's fault, according to this blessing. "But I pronounce the blessing of thy father Jacob upon thee, and thou shalt have a name and a place in thy father's family because of thy tears and prayers, for thou hast prevailed unto the obtaining this blessing. Thou shalt yet be comforted, for the days of thy tribulation shall have an end, and the time of thy rejoicing shall come, and thou shalt be blessed with an abundance of the good things in life." And her tribulation did come to an end, I guess, because Calvin died 2 years later. Catherine's husband, Jenkins, was also out of the church at the time of this patriarchal blessing meeting because of his use of alcohol. And his blessing says, "Thou hast turned thy back upon the cause of God. Thou hast conducted thyself wickedly and brought a reproach upon the church because thou art a member of my family." And Joseph Smith Sr. goes on to command Jenkins to repent, promising that if he does repent, then his sins will be blotted out and he will be a mighty man in the earth, which is more than was promised to Calvin. Catherine's blessing kind of follows a similar pattern to Sophronia's, where a lot of it ends up being about her husband's sin. But Joseph Smith Sr. at least has some more things to say to her. He says, "Thy care and thy anxiety for thy parents from thy youth are not forgotten. They are fresh in my mind. My heart mourns for thee in consequence of the transgression of thy husband." He goes on to promise that her seed, meaning her descendants, will survive until the end of the world, and that she herself will live to a good old age and depart to rest with thy Redeemer when thou art satisfied with this life. "But before thou shalt go hence, even when thy judgment is perfected, thou shalt teach the young of thy sex virtue and sobriety, and those things which are duties of wives and mothers." So even though he has some things to say to her besides discussion of her husband's sin, a lot of it ends up being about the importance of her conforming to 19th century gender norms. Her primary calling in this life is apparently to teach young women virtue and sobriety and those things which are the duties of wives and mothers. So, it says a lot about the role of women in 19th century society that this is that the women's blessings, the sisters' blessings, had so much to do with their husbands and with female gender norms. And so no wonder these women have been mostly eclipsed in Mormon memory and historical memory. As for baby Lucy Jr., her blessing says, "Lucy, my child, even my youngest child, the child of my old age, thou hast been a comfort to my heart." Joseph Smith Sr. expresses concern that she's surrounded by the follies and vanities of the Gentiles, and he really drives home the point that she's young and that she needs adult supervision to make sure that she stays on the straight and narrow path. Spends a lot of time dwelling on how young she is. And then he promises that she'll live to a good old age and have inheritance in the land of Zion and be of worth among thy sex after thou hast had experience. Thou shalt be taught much wisdom and learning. Thou shalt have dreams and visions. The holy angels shall minister unto thee. So that's kind of cool. She's promised dreams and visions, and he envisions her apparently getting an education, wisdom, and learning. It is, however, he can't resist the references to her gender. He says, you shall be of worth among thy sex, meaning apparently not of worth to everyone, just of worth to women, which is a kind of a sad thing to put in there. But she is promised some pretty cool stuff there. So it's nice to see that the girls didn't get completely forgotten in this family meeting. They did get some promises. They got some expressions of paternal love, paternal care, some appreciation of the things that they had done for the family. And so we as historians and as people remembering this period should take the time to remember these women.
Okay, there's the end of one of our longer timeouts. So during the early child-raising years, Lucy records a number of dreams and visions that she and Joseph Smith Sr. experienced. And so it seems likely she would have shared these with the children. And so the children, particularly Joseph, who seemed to pay attention, grew up in this family where they not only acknowledged the existence of these kinds of experiences, but they're consciously making them part of their identity as a family. But as we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, these types of visions aren't really that unique. While with our modern sensibilities, we see these visionary people as outliers, at this point, they seem to have been pretty common during the early 19th century. And so current Mormons will highlight Joseph's quote-unquote first vision around 1820 as this mandate to begin the LDS Church. But early accounts of his experience will describe really a personal manifestation, which, like we said, it's not all that uncommon from other people living at that time.
During the 19th century, Joseph's vision was not emphasized nearly as much as it is today. So my generation, we were taught about the first vision. We all know the story of Joseph going into the Grove of Trees, seeing heavenly beings, and this is the start of Mormonism. But this isn't really what they talked a lot about. It was really more focused on the Book of Mormon. Scholar Kathleen Flake, in her excellent book on the 1904 through the 1907 Reed Smoot hearings, argues that this period marks a transition point where the Mormons start to begin to look at Joseph Smith's vision as a way to mark their identity. But before that, the vision story wasn't really talked about, and it receives a lot more attention in the mid-20th century. And so my generation, my parents' generation, would have heard a lot about it, but early Mormon saints didn't really talk about that. We don't have a lot of evidence of them discussing that. In Fawn Brody's book, No Man Knows My History, she referred to it as a pretended revelation. In 1965, Paul Cheesman, a graduate student at BYU, made some waves when he included the essentially unknown 1832 account of the first vision, most of it in Joseph Smith's handwriting, as an appendix to his master's thesis. 2 years later, non-Mormon writer Wesley Walters published a pamphlet and argued that the historical context for Joseph Smith's description of his first vision didn't fit. Walters really rattled some chains and set off a coordinated response. And numerous articles and dialogue in BYU studies were examples of Mormon scholars taking the first vision seriously for the first time. And now we have essays on the multiple accounts of the first vision.
So part of this scholarly response was centered around basic documentary editing questions. How long after the fact were the documents created? What are the differences? How do we interpret these differences? I mean, this is how, when you're looking at historical evidence, these are the types of criteria that you use to evaluate them. And as Lindsay's pointed out in Year of Polygamy in a couple places, Joseph Smith's vision and all the different accounts are almost always treated differently from other subjects. And the criteria by which historians judge documents and memories really aren't applied in this case. And so the first attempt to document his experience didn't happen until 1832. So by his account, that would make it 12 years after this experience. So, I mean, how many times have you heard historians talking about a source created that long after an event as being not suspicious, but should at least be taken with a grain of salt because it's that long after. This account, like we pointed out, is interesting because it's largely in his hand. It's very simple. So Joseph says he saw, quote, the Lord. So no mention of two people. It mentions that he's forgiven of his sins and told that, quote, the world lieth in sin at this time, close quote. So in this account, the event is not really associated with Joseph wondering which church is true. We should point out he does mention his own conclusion that, quote, there was no society or denomination that was built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament, close quote. And he's not told that none of the churches are true. So then, 3 years later, in 1835, a very colorful visitor, Joshua the Jewish minister, who's this great dude who goes around with all sorts of assumed identities. So he shows up and asks about this vision. And so as a result, Joseph writes an account of this in his journal. Well, a scribe does. And this account indicates that Joseph wanted to be, quote, right as to which church was correct, and mentions that two, quote, personages visited him. But still, it's a personal matter in this account. His sins are forgiven. That's about it. So not until the 1838, quote-unquote, official account does the first vision, as Mormons currently understand it, come into focus.
So yeah, the first vision becomes, in my generation, like I said, this story that we all know. It's a very faith-promoting story. And I'm going to actually play a video on LDS.org that's talking about this. Now, remember, this video from LDS.org was just published in 2017 and then revised from the Church History Museum because they are now contending with all of these different accounts. But I want you to get a sense of how the story is now currently being told.
Between 1832 and 1844, Joseph Smith and some of his closest friends recorded at least 9 accounts of Joseph's first vision experience given on different occasions to different audiences. The most detailed of these accounts, written in 1838, has been published in a volume of scripture called The Pearl of Great Price. What you're about to see draws upon all of the written first vision accounts to provide additional perspectives and insights into this remarkable event.
My name is Joseph Smith. When I was young, there was in the place where we lived an unusual excitement on the subject of religion. My mind became seriously impressed with regard to the welfare of my soul. I pondered many things in my heart. I felt to mourn for my own sins and the sins of the world, but upon inquiring about the plan of salvation, I found that there was a great clash in religious sentiment. This was grief to my soul. I knew not who was right or who was wrong, and I considered it of the first importance that I should be right in matters that involved eternal consequences. I wanted to get religion, too. I wanted to feel and shout like the rest, but could feel nothing. I was one day reading the Epistle of James. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and it shall be given him. It seemed to enter with great force into every feeling of my heart. After I retired into the place where I had previously designed to go, having looked around me and finding myself alone, I kneeled down and began to offer up the desires of my heart to God. I cried unto the Lord for mercy, for there was none else to whom I could go to obtain mercy. It was the first time in my life that I had made the attempt to pray vocally.
Oh, God.
Immediately, I was seized upon by some power which entirely overcame me and had such astonishing influence over me as to bind my tongue, so I could not speak. My mind filled with doubts and all manner of inappropriate images. It seemed to me for a time as if I were doomed to sudden destruction, but exerting all my powers to call upon God to deliver me,
Lord,
my mouth was open.
Have mercy on me.
And my tongue liberated.
Forgive me.
Joseph.
This is my beloved son. Hear him.
Joseph, thy sins are forgiven thee. Behold, I am the Lord of glory. I was crucified for the world, that all those who believe on my name may have eternal life. The world lieth in sin. They've turned aside from the gospel and keep not my commandments. They draw near to me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me. They teach for doctrines the commandments of men, having a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof. Go not after them. Wait patiently. At a future time, the complete truth of the gospel will be revealed to you.
When the light had departed, I had no strength. Peace and calm filled my mind. My soul was filled with love. For many days I could rejoice with great joy, and the Lord was with me. I had received a promise that the fullness of the gospel should at some future time be made known unto me. And I had actually seen a light, and in the midst of that light I saw two personages, and they did in reality speak to me. I knew it, and I knew God knew it, and I could not deny it.
First thing I would like to comment on is the dramatic nature of it. As a missionary, I can recall pro and con discussions on how to present this to people. And some would kneel down on the floor and basically act it out in dramatic voices and crying. And so obviously, as it's become this central piece of how the origins of Mormonism happen, it's become more of a production in many ways.
Yeah, I was struck by the dramatic reading. Like the man was almost in pain. You know, I was thinking Mormons, it's like an honor when you're asked to be an actor for these things. And I'm sure the guy like fasted and prayed about this for a while before he did it. And it was a great performance. Nothing against that. It's just, I don't think that it's so interesting to see how events that people live sort of become mythologized. It's true that the official account that you talked about in 1838 was part of a larger project to create a full Mormon history. And so this project would run into some snags to create this Mormon history. Joseph Smith's scribes tended to die or apostatize at really high rates. So that was part of the problem. But this time they kept this history going. This is by far the longest account and gives the most detail of the culture of the burned over district, which we talked about earlier. And while the official 1838 account notes that Joseph Smith was forbidden to join any of the churches, It still doesn't really hint that he would start a church. Then in 1842, Joseph Smith created another account, the last that he would personally supervise. This account was part of an outside history project that also spawned the Articles of Faith, which is a Mormon thing in our scriptures that outlines what we believe. This 42 account added the detail that the two personages, quote, exactly resembled each other in features and likeness, and included a promise that the fullness of the gospel should at some point, at some future time, be made known unto me, end quote. And this is so interesting when we talked last episode about Lucy's origin story of how she was seeking and then she prayed and then she heard God's voice saying, seek. And now Joseph Smith is sort of following that. And Joseph Smith Sr. would be similar. He had all kinds of visions. He was making revelations. So Joseph Smith grew up in a very, I would say, spiritually and mystic home where they would go out in the forest. They would, you know, try different herb medicines. They would do certain rituals. There's one account of them doing an animal sacrifice.
And this will lead into what's called the magic worldview that we'll probably do an episode on. And that forms a large part of the Smith family views and beliefs, as well as a lot of their contemporaries. So we'll get into that more. But so what do we make of different accounts? So the traditional LDS approach to this has been in recent years to say, as noted in that video, that it was given to different audiences and different times, and line upon line, precept upon precept is invoked also. And I mean, if you read the accounts just one after another, you can clearly see a progression. They become more detailed and they start to focus in on specific pieces, like that there were two rather than just one person, and that it wasn't just a personal matter in that Joseph Smith was now forgiven of his sins, but that it presaged this creation of a new, correct, restored religious organization. So by reading it, I mean, you can just see how things are progressing, like I said. So the cynical side of this is just that he's telling a better story each time. And there certainly are details that are not in the earlier accounts. And the idea that if you are, you know, because you're talking to different audiences, you emphasize different things. To me, in the first account, the 1832 account, done privately, there would be no need to not mention the fact that there were two people, if there were two people. Because it is private. You're not going to upset anyone by writing a private account of something. So it seems that as Joseph begins to develop the idea that God is not only has a body, but that there's God and Jesus are two separate, distinct people. Not just deities, but I mean, you know, with physical bodies. So to me, that's a very clear development there.
Yeah, and this is going to be a point of contention in modern Mormonism. Ex-Mormons are really troubled by this, and faithful Mormons have been really troubled by this, and it's led them to leave the church especially because the emphasis in the 20th century on the first vision, it became the sort of codified story that we believed was a history. We were taught it as a history, and it was sort of, a cherry-picked version of heritage history. I call it heritage-based history, which is a real problem in the 20th century as we move away from the people that actually experience this history and its retellings from their progeny. And so I, as a researcher, will talk to family members all the time and they will tell this glowing story, family history of their ancestor, which is rooted in some truth, but it's usually sort of this glossed over version of the history. And this is exactly what happens with Mormon identity and Mormon history. And you can see that in the video. It's dramatized. They used emotional music. It's meant to not just tell the history, but it's meant to catch your spirit and convert you to this idea. And so that's how a lot of this early history would be portrayed, even though it was really messy on the ground. And now it's time for our special segment, a recommendation for your homework, your extra reading, and book club. It's our Books of Mormon review, where every episode we highlight one key book you should definitely know about.
Today's book is Rough Stone Rolling, and is written by historian Richard Bushman. And it was both a historical and a cultural biography of Joseph Smith. So it came out of an earlier book that he wrote called Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism that was originally slated to be part of a new comprehensive Mormon history in the 1970s. This was a project during the time of Leonard Arrington. But the project was canceled as an official church project, and so authors that had finished their books were just left to publish them wherever. So he did this book with the University of Illinois Press, and it was really, really well done. Won awards and was very highly regarded, but it only took the history up until the creation of the church in 1830, essentially. So after that was published, he went back and wrote a full-length biography of Joseph Smith. And as part of this research, he was privy to the early research and writing of the what became the Joseph Smith Papers Project. So it was rooted in very good, careful history. So he was drawing on a good foundation of sources and research. And Bushman is, at the same time, a faithful LDS member. He was he's a patriarch and active believing Mormon, but also a very good historian. So his specialty was early American Revolutionary period, and he did a lot with material culture. So he's looked at farming and things like that. So he's a respected Mormon, but also a respected historian. And so the biography that he wrote was excellent. It was the first one done by a believing Mormon that was willing to treat Joseph Smith as a person, a three-dimensional, flawed person. And Bushman was candid in saying that he saw quite a bit of value in Fawn Brody's book. It was well written, and it breathed. It was of a person, not some two-dimensional flat figure. And as a result of his candid nature, he was attacked by some Mormons for being too much of a historian. But then on the other side, some historians attacked him for being too much of a Mormon. So he concluded he'd probably hit the right target. So we would highly recommend this as a biography of Joseph Smith, but also a history of the church in some ways.
Okay, so if you haven't picked up Rough Stone Rolling yet, I mean, it's sort of the quintessential Mormon history book. Everybody check that out, and we'll talk to you next episode.
For my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.